one of the greatest mistakes that we see people making in step four is everybody wants to sit down and put off step four and procrastinate until they can do it perfect. We'll never do it perfect. We do the best we absolutely can in step four. And the book recognizes that. We made an inventory of our grosser handicaps. What are they, Joe?
Resentments, fear, sexual harm, and harm done to others other than sexual.
We've made an inventory of our grosser handicaps.
Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightening, and inconsiderate attitudes.
See, that's the best we can do in step four. We'll never do it perfect. There's another step later on where we're going to repeat this process over and over and over for the rest of our lives. The best we can do in step four is the best we can do. But if we get on with it and get it done, we're going to get some positive results from it. And it gives us the information we now need to be able to work the rest of the program. Without step four, you can't do 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. You just can't be done. So our suggestion is always, we jump right into step four, right after step three.
And yesterday we had about an hour and 20 minutes on step four. This morning we got about an hour and a half on step four. That's less than 3 hours. I submit that you can do your inventory in less than 3 hours with this information if you want to and get on with getting well. It's a simple, simple process, and the simpler we keep it, the better. And we can get on, we can start getting well right here if we want to.
And you don't really have to understand it.
No.
You just go ahead and do what it says to do. And when you get through with it, you look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's why I had to do it that way, when you get the results from it. Now, I don't know whether you all have noticed or not, but nearly all the information in the big book on sex is on page 69. I don't know that that has any meaning at all, but that just happens to be where it is, We heard a story about a young lady who came to AA, and she went to her sponsor, and she said, "Sponsor, I got a problem with this sex thing." Her sponsor said, "What is it?" And she said, "Well, sober, I don't know what to do in the sexual area." She said, "Anything I've ever done in that area, tried to attract a member of the opposite sex or anything else, has always been while drinking. And I just don't know what to do sober." Her sponsor said, "Well, go home and get your big book out. Go to page 69 and read it. And it'll answer any questions you might have in the sexual area." So the young lady went home, got out her big book, proceeded to read. But she got confused on page numbers. Instead of page 69, she read page 96. Just for the hell of it, go to 96 for just a moment and see what she read, and then we're going to take a break. I think that's one of the most appropriate things I've ever read. It just goes on and on and on. Let's take about a 15 or 20 minute break. Thank you all for the donation for the raffle and the dust jackets and et cetera. Goes to a good cause. Like we said before, the first of this month we had $621,000 in that trust fund. And gradually over a period of years, not only do we pay out a bunch of money to Dr. Bob's house and the Wilson Inn, but it continually grows and it'll get a little bit bigger every year. Someday it'll be worth $1 million. The beautiful part about it is it's set up in such a way that nobody can touch it. I can't touch it. Nobody else can touch it. The only way it can ever be changed would be if the board of directors from Dr. Bob's house and from the Wilson Inn, if they got together and they would have to petition a judge in the state of Missouri in order to change it. So it'll never be changed in the future. It will be a permanent thing. And thank you for your donations to it.
We have a question here. We have a question here. Stand up if you would.
I didn't either. How much did the raffle bring? About $1,600 for the raffle. There'll probably be $250 or $300 for the dust jackets, I imagine. I haven't counted that either. So,
all the excess funds from your registration, plus our expenses, are also going to the foundation.
Good.
That'll probably be in excess of $3,000.
All right. Good. Be kind of hard to beat that with a stick, wouldn't it?
Last summer, they put little small air conditioners in all the rooms up at the Wilson Inn, all the bedrooms. They were pretty warm. So that's one little thing they did recently. The year before, they put a sprinkler system throughout the whole system. So it's continually improving those facilities.
Okay, let's go back now to page 72. The rest of this is going to go pretty fast. I think we'll probably be out of here by 1:30 anyhow, maybe a little bit before that. We've already done the majority of the hard work now in doing our step 3 and step 4. Now we're going to take this information we've gathered up in step 4, and we're going to start taking some action now using this information that we found when we took step 4. So let's go to page 72, chapter 6, into action.
Now this is not into thinking, it's into action. Action is the magic word in Alcoholics Anonymous. Having made our personal inventory, well, what should we do about it? Well, that's a good question. We've been trying to get a new attitude. Remember Dr. Jung told Roland, ideas, emotions, and attitudes. We're trying to get some new attitudes. A new relationship with our Creator. Back on page 45, it said the main object of this book was enable me to find a power greater than myself, which would solve my problem. And that's certainly a new relationship with my Creator, which I didn't have before I got here. And discover the obstacles in our path. And what are those obstacles we've discovered? The resentment and the fears and the harms we've done to others, not only sexually but other ways. We've admitted certain defects. And what are those defects? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate attitudes. We've ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our parts, which, when completed, will mean that we've admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
Okay, we have to look at a couple of words now for just a moment. We know that step 5 says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. But if you'll notice here in the narrative, he said this requires action on our part, which completed will mean that we admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. In the step, he used the word wrongs, but in the narrative, he used the word defects. And people used to ask Bill about this. They'd say, Bill, why did you use wrongs when you wrote the step? But in talking about it in the narrative, you used the words defects. And by the way, Bill, what's the difference anyhow between a wrong in 5, a defect in 6, and a shortcoming in 7. Now, Joe and I have known two ladies that worked with and for Bill for years. They both tell us the same thing. People would ask Bill that question, and he would kind of rear back, and he would say, when I took English and writing courses in college, they taught me not to use the same words over and over. That shows how dumb you really are.
You know, you know, you know.
He said, there's really no difference in these things. He said, in step 4, we're going to find those things that block us off from God. In step 5, we're going to talk about them to another human being. In step 6, we're going to become willing to turn them loose. In step 7, we're going to ask God to take them away. And he said, you can call them anything you want to. A wrong, a fault, a mistake, a defect, a shortcoming, a personality flaw, or whatever you wish to call them. So we're convinced in our own mind that as he uses these words interchangeably back and forth, he's talking about the same thing in 4, 5, 6, and 7. Now we'll follow up on that. We'll see him doing it through the rest of the book here. I even followed up further later on and went to the 12 and 12. Not only does he do the same thing in the 12 and 12, he even does it worse in the 12 and 12, calling them all different kinds of things. So we think they're the same identical thing. We found those things that block us from God in 4. We're going to talk about them to another God and another human being in 5. Be willing to turn loose of them in 6. And we'll ask God to take them away in 7.
He said, this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects.
He does it again right there.
With another person. We think we've done well enough at admitting these things to ourselves. Well, there's doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find that a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. Many have thought it necessary to go much further. We'd be more reconciled discussing ourselves with another person when we see a good reason why we should do so. Well, the best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. See, I did the very best I could do with this inventory with my limited knowledge. I did the best I could do. A solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. I need another human being who knows what we're doing from the big book to help me see things that I couldn't see. I saw all that I could, but now he can look at me and see things within me that I couldn't see. To give you, for instance, I can look around this room and I can see a number of defective characters
and
in
one
here.
One sitting right there
one
in the
right
second
there,
row.
Right, waving his hand, he's a defective character. Plain to see. Because there's nothing between me and you except air. But between me and me is a lifetime of rationalization and justification. And I can't see those things. Now, if I had any defects of character, I'm sure you could see them. I can see yours, you see. It's hard for me to see mine. I need another human being to look at me and help me see things within me that I couldn't see.
He says time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they've turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they failed. Well, we think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, honesty, in the sense we find it necessary, until they told someone all else, all their life story. Now there's the little statement that screwed us up on step 4. We read about all that life story and we thought, well, that's what they wanted us to do then in step 4 is write our life story. And like we said yesterday, you know, 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my drinking. But it very effectively covers up to 5% that does. But I'll tell you what I've done. If I have shared all my resentments with another human being, I've shared all my life story resentment-wise. They didn't come just today. You know, those resentments have been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. I've shared all my life story resentment-wise. If I've shared all my fears with another human being, I've shared all my fears, all my life story fears-wise. They didn't come in my head just today. Those fears been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. If I've shared all my harms done to other human beings, then I've shared all my life story harms-wise. You know, I didn't hurt people today or just yesterday. I've been hurting people as far back as I can remember. My mother said to me one time, she said, Charlie, you were the meanest kid I ever saw. She said, I had a little trouble loving you myself. And when Mama's got a little trouble loving you, look out, there's something wrong going on. See? So if I've shared all my life story resentments, if I've shared all my life story with fears, if I've shared all my life story with harms done to others, then I've shared all my life story. Because that's what it all revolves around, is those resentments and those fears and those harms done to others and etc. So we don't have any quarrel with that statement today at all. Now here's the real reason. We need to take this to another, not only to God, but to another human being and share it. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He's very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more drinking. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spend thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery. You know, we need to face the fact that we alcoholics have become the world's greatest con artist. You have to if you're going to be a practicing alcoholic. You have to learn how to lie, how to cheat, how to con, how to manipulate, how to steal. And I think the one you have to con the most is yourself. I don't think you and I could live with ourselves if we had to honestly see what's going on when we're out there doing our thing. But you see, we don't ever have to see that because we had that little convenient thing called resentments that we played them over and over in our head and transferred blame to others and made ourselves as the pure driven snow. I don't think we could have lived without the ability to do that. Now, if you've been conning yourself for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years, you come to AA, you do step 4, you be just as honest with yourself as you can. But we need to face the fact that it's impossible for us to be honest with ourselves. No human being, I don't care how great they are spiritually, no human being can be completely honest with themselves. Rationalization, justification, excuses always step in to justify the things we're doing, the things we want to do. So in order for me to get a good, honest look at myself, I need to take my step 5 or my step 4 to somebody who has walked this walk before me. Somebody who understands steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 according to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody who can look at it from an outside view and see the truth in that stuff. And let them help me see those things that I can't see. Now, they're not going to change anything in column 1. They're not going to change anything in column 2. They're probably going to change some things in column 3. They helped me out in that sex area. You know, I said this was caused by the social instinct. He said, oh, no. This is purely the sex instinct. I said this was caused by the sex instinct. He said, oh, no, you're just trying to build your self-esteem here. Not going to change anything in column 4. They'll probably change some things in column 5. You know, I remember one case I said this was caused by inconsideration. He said, no, this is just plain damn dishonesty. That's all this is. And he helped me see things about me I could not see. That's the purpose of step 5. Now, I know confession is good for the soul. I know if you belong to a religious denomination which requires it, you probably ought to go ahead and do that. But I also think we need to take this step 5 to somebody who understands our program, somebody who's walked this walk before us. If they have, then they can help us see the things we can't see. If they haven't, then all we're going to get out of it is confession, not knowledge, but simply confession from it. So my criteria has always been another AA member, one who's worked the steps, one who understands 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 according to the big book, and they can really help us see this. If it's a priest, it's in AA, great. You can do them both at the same time. But otherwise, it's probably not going to help too much. Page 74. Page 74 deals with who to take this thing with. Now remember, when the book was published in 1939, there were no AA sponsors up here in Michigan. There were none in California. There were none in Texas. The first person that got this book, they had a hard time finding somebody to take step five with. And that's what this page all deals with on page 74. But that's not true today. We've got plenty of good AA people, plenty of good AA sponsors that really understand this thing and they know what they're talking about. To me, that's the only criteria. Do they understand it? If they do, they can help me. If they don't understand it, they're not going to help me at all. Page 75. This deals with how we take this step.
It said, when we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. There's that time factor again. We have a written inventory or prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we're engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They'll be honored by our confidence. And I remember calling my sponsor, Franklin, and asking if I might come over on Friday. He lived in Olive Branch, Mississippi. AA World Headquarters at that time. Franklin thought it was. His group was. So I went over there and sat down with Franklin, and I said, well, you know, I've got my fifth step. I'm going to do my fifth step with you. And he said, I understand. That's good. I understand what you're trying to do. Of course, he did. Been sober a long time. He said, but the first thing I want you to do is this: you and I do the third step prayer. Let's ask God to be a part of this and bring him into this thing too, the kind of sponsor he was. So we did that. And our book said, we park at our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once having taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. More promises, by the way. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And so I got my little forms out and I began to share these with Franklin. I've realized today from those experiences and the fifth steps I've received since then how important these forms are. Because now we can take that item there in column one. We can discuss these things all the way across from left to right. Always we've been going from top to bottom. But in the fifth step we go from left to right. We discuss this person in great detail. Him asking me questions about that person, my relationship to him, how I knew him, what happened, so on and so forth. And then when we finish with that, we go to the next one. And we discuss that in great detail, him asking me questions about that. You see, helping me see things that I couldn't see, getting acquainted with this situation so he can help me see things that I couldn't see. What part of self was affected? He helped me see those things within me that I didn't know. And we talk about those in great detail. Column four the same way, in great detail. Column five especially is where we want to know, were we selfish in this instant? Was we dishonest in this instant? Were we self-seeking and frightened in this instant? Were we inconsiderate in this instant? And discussing those things in great detail, at depth, all we want to. It keeps us, also keeps us in some kind of order. I don't know if you've ever accepted a fifth step where they didn't have these things particularly, and they just talk about everything in the world and all over the place. Never knew what they were talking about. But with this form, we keep us in order. Once we've discussed this left, right, all the way across, then we go to the next one and discuss it all the way across. And we go to the next one, discuss it all the way across. And it keeps us in order and helps us see things more clearly. Very valuable in the area of the fifth step. And then, as Charlie said earlier, we've told someone else all our life story, resentment-wise. All our life story, fears-wise. All our life stories, sexual-wise. All our life stories and harms we've done to other people. We tell the whole story. And they're asking me questions all along about this. And I'm sharing them with him. and he's helping me see things. Very valuable, very, very valuable. Because it's this fifth step is the beginning of setting me free. See, I was in the bondage of self and misunderstanding and ignorance for most of my life. And I began to see things more clearly, how they should have been, how I should have acted, what I should have done, instead of what I did. So the next time these things come up, I got some information that I can use now to help me see things differently and better, so I can stay out of those troubles that I used to create for myself. And another thing, once you see those things, you can't blame anybody else. You can't blame it. You know, no more victims in AA. We won't let each other be victims. My spouse won't let me be a victim. It's me, you see. Charlie.
We want to emphasize as we look at these action steps that they all have a positive result. Nothing negative about any of them. Bill referred way back in his story about that wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we were going to build and pass through to freedom. We talked about willingness, step one, was the foundation. Believing, step two, was the cornerstone. Decision, step three, was the keystone. We're building that arch. And he referred to that as the spiritual experience or the spiritual awakening. So we're actually beginning to undergo that spiritual experience, if it's fast, spiritual awakening if it's slow, as we progress through the steps. We don't have to wait till we get to step 12 to get something out of it. I'm going to reread that paragraph again that Joe just read. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Now here's the result. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had spiritual beliefs. Step two, we came to believe. But now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. My God, what a change in personality. As we work this step and really share these things, and a lot of these fears begin to fall away from us, and we begin to experience this thing right here in step five. Now, if you've done step four and you've done step five, you've done a lot of work. You're probably tired. You probably need a little rest. And the big book's going to give you a little rest now. He says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Now, he didn't say 32 days, did he? You know, every time he mentions time, it's almost immediately right now. He's going to let us be quiet for an hour. Carefully viewing what we've done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. We don't know Him yet, but we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals or steps. He just didn't want to say steps twice in a row. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we've omitted anything. For we're building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Referring again to that wonderfully effective spiritual structure. Page 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. That is all of step 6. And step 6 said we're entirely willing to have God remove all these defects of character. Well, He didn't even mention defects of character in there, did He? He did mention those things which we have admitted are objectionable. Now surely in our inventory, when we looked out in that fifth column and we saw that old selfish, that old dishonest, that old self-seeking frightened, that old inconsiderate human being that we had become based on a life run on self-will, when we could see that those are the things that caused us to do the things that hurt other people and caused them to retaliate and caused us to resent and have the fears and the guilt and remorse, then surely, those things have now become objectionable to us. Are we now ready to turn it loose? Are we ready to let go of the selfishness? Are we ready to let go of the dishonesty? Are we ready to let go of that self-seeking, frightened condition? Are we ready to let go of the inconsideration? If we have, then we're through. If we are, then we're through with step six. But the book recognizes that self cannot overcome self always. Because it says, if we're not ready, if we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. You know, you would think when we see what those things do to us, that we would be more than willing to turn them loose. But let's face it, sometimes we human beings are funny things. Now, sometimes we would rather sit in today's pain and suffering, because we're kind of used to that and we kind of know how to handle that. Sometimes we'd rather sit in today's pain and suffering than take a chance on changing in the future, because we don't know what change is going to bring. And sometimes fear will keep us from being willing to get rid of these things. You know, I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I'm going to be able to do that step six thing. And he said, why? And I said, if God takes away all my character defects, I'm not going to have any personality left at all. And he said, you're about 100% right. But he says, what you don't know is if God takes them away, they will have to be replaced with something different. And he said, what replaces them will be so much better than anything you've ever had before, you'll wonder why it took you so long to get ready to get rid of them. But he said, Charlie, you'll never know that unless you're willing to take a chance. He said, now if you're not willing, you go talk to God. And between you and God, you work this thing out. And when you become willing to turn them loose, then you will have done step six. Now then he says, when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing you should have all to be good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character. Whoop. We're in step seven now. And step seven said shortcomings. But here in the narrative, he says defects of character. You see what he's done to us? He confused the hell out of us is what he did. Until we finally got him figured out. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character, shortcoming, personality flaw, mistake, or whatever you want to call it, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step seven. Bang, bang. Bang, bang. Are you ready to have God remove your defects of character? If you are, you've done six. Have you humbly asked Him to do so? If you have, you've done seven. But please don't make the mistake I did. Knowing that God is all-powerful, and knowing that God can do whatever He wants to do, I thought all I'll have to do is just turn to God and say, okay, God, here I am, warts and all. Give me the $29.95 special, zap me and make me as pure as the driven snow, and I'd never have to worry about those things again. But I found out it doesn't work that way at all. God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. He will not do for me what I can do for myself. I don't have the power to remove a defective character. Only God has that power. But God cannot remove a defective character and leave a void in my personality. The natural law says nature abhors a vacuum. No such thing as a void or a vacuum. There's always something rushing in to fill it up. If God removes a defective character, then something else is going to have to replace that in my personality. And the only thing that can replace it will be the opposite of it. And if I want God to take away my selfishness, then I must gather all the courage I can and all the strength that I can get from God, and in any given situation, start practicing unselfishness. Now, that's almost impossible for me to do, because I've never been unselfish in my lifetime before I came to AA. And as God removed, and as I practiced the opposite over and over and over and over, gradually the old idea died, and a new idea began to take its place. Today I find myself in most circumstances a relatively unselfish human being. If I want God to take away my dishonesty, then I must start trying to practice honesty in every given situation. Not only cash register, but every other way. And it's very difficult for a guy like me, who's been a thief and a liar and a cheat all of his life, to start practicing honesty. It's alien to my nature entirely. But as I start practicing honesty and God starts taking away dishonesty, slowly, 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 the old idea dies and it's replaced by a new idea. I find in most cases today I'm an honest human being. Not 100%, not perfect, never will be, but usually I'm an honest human being. If I want Him to take away my self-seeking, frightened condition, then I'm going to have to start practicing faith and courage. I'm going to have to start forcing myself to do the things I was afraid to do with God's help. I'm going to have to start forcing myself to quit doing the things that I was afraid to quit with God's help. And slowly, 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 I've become a human being who reacts with faith and courage in most circumstances. If I want Him to take away my inconsideration, then I must do something that's almost impossible for me to do in the beginning. I must start considering other people and their needs and their wants and their desires ahead of my own. Completely alien to my nature. But as God removes and I practice, slowly the old idea dies, and I become a considerate human being. I am not what I was when I came to AA. I have been reborn. I'm not what I was when I first came here. And with God's help, and with my practicing over and over and over and over and over, my personality has changed into an entirely different kind of personality. I think I'm beginning to understand what the book says when it said some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. You can't be selfish and unselfish at the same time. You can't be honest and dishonest at the same time. You can't have faith and courage and be self-seeking and frightened at the same time. You can't be considerate and inconsiderate at the same time. You're going to be one or the other. And only we can make that decision. Now be careful. Be careful. Because if you buy into this idea, then that means from this day on, you are responsible for who you are, what you think, how you feel, and how you act. Because we no longer have to be that way any longer. We can become entirely different people. I think we're the luckiest people in the world. You know, most people out there are sick. Most of them are going to the grave sick, not even knowing they're sick. We not only know we're sick, we know what's wrong with us. And we have the tools in 6 and 7 to change ourselves into entirely different human beings. We get to live two lifetimes in one lifetime. Most people never get that opportunity. These two little steps are two steps that Bill added when he wrote the 12 steps. They were not in the Oxford group steps. And he could see a loophole that the alcoholic mind was slipping through. And he said, we need to tighten that up. We need to have some way to get rid of these character defects. And he added 6 and 7. Two little paragraphs. And probably just as important as anything in the entire book itself. I think we're the luckiest people alive, Joe.
I love 6 and 7, yeah. There's always a paradox in AA, isn't there? Everything's always backwards from what you think it is. To show you about a paradox. Has anybody ever called their sponsor so they could listen? Call them up so we can talk, right? You're supposed to call them up to listen, you see. But that's a paradox. The paradox here is that they use the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters to do steps 1 and 2. They did steps 3. They took 4 pages to do step 3, 8 pages to do step 4, 5 pages to do step 5, a whole chapter on working with others. The paradox is that the two of the biggest and most important steps of all of Alcoholics Anonymous is on 2 little paragraphs. 2 of the biggest steps in Alcoholics Anonymous is on these 2 little paragraphs. And I don't know about you, but the first time I went through the steps, I skipped over those little babies because they were fast. Boom, 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 went right on through them. But those are the tools of change. By the time I had gotten to step 6, I could see what I had become through the inventory process and discussing these with another person. And I didn't like what I had become. And some doubt began to creep into my mind. Can God really, really, change me from that to something else? Can He really do that? And I had to reaffirm a statement that I read earlier. He said, God either is or He isn't. God either can or He can't. What's my choice going to be? And I had to reaffirm that He could. And 6 and 7 are the tools of change, the tools of acceptance. There was a movement going on here a while back about changing, acceptance. People walk around, I'm just accepting things. I couldn't do that. There's a process by which we have to go through to accept things. Acceptance is not an event. It's a process. 6 and 7 is the process that we go through to change today. I know what the type of change he's talking about. To change from what I had become to what he intends for me to be. That's a marvelous experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and in life, to be that which God intends for me to be. See, He didn't make no junk, and I thought I was junk for a long time. I am becoming that which God intended for me to be. And where did He get these steps from? And these are the tools of acceptance and the tools of change. There was a story in that other big book. This guy's name was Judas. Judas could not accept what he'd done. No way to do that. So what did he do? Killed himself, didn't he? That's the importance of acceptance, to accept what we've done. Judas couldn't do that. He killed himself. That's how important that is. There was another story in there. This guy's name was Saul. And Saul was riding his ass on the way to Damascus, the way I read it. And big old booming voice come out of the sky and a big bolt of lightning come down and knocked him off his ass on his ass, the way I read it. He's dusting himself off and the big voice said, hey, Saul, can we talk? He said, yeah, we can talk. He said, well, yeah, he got his attention, see. He said, yeah, we can talk. What do you want to talk about? And he said, basically, Saul, you've been a very selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate individual, and you've harmed an awful lot of people with those kind of attitudes, and I want you to change. And he said, well, how do you change? How can I change from that? He said, do these things, 6 and 7. And if you'll do these things, you'll change. And then when you change, we'll call you Paul. And we all know that Paul was one of the greatest writers the world's ever known, you see. And he was in a little town in Corinthians one time, and somebody asked Paul a question. He said, hey, Paul, so what's the secret to life? Everybody wants to know that. He said, well, the secret to life is daily dying. the old Saul had to die so the new Paul could come alive. 6 and 7, two of the biggest steps in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, to change from what I had become to that which God intends for me to be. Very, very important not to skip over 6 and 7. I am not what I used to be, you see. And if I stay like I used to be, then I know better today. It must be because I want to be that way. And I used to be a victim. I'm not a victim anymore. The whole world trying to be a victim of something. And in AA, thank God, most of our sponsors won't let us be victims. There's a way that we can change and not be a victim. See, can't blame it on them anymore. I have tools of change, tools of acceptance, if I'm willing to do that.
Tell them about the time you bought the lettuce.
Oh, yeah.
The salad, practicing honesty.
Yeah, I was going to buy some salad one time. And
it's an example of practicing 6 and 7.
Mixing some salad up, and my wife is going to cook us a nice dinner when she's on her way home from work. And I fixed some dinner and went by the Safeway in our town and bought some salad stuff and went up to the checkout, and I handed the lady $10, and she counted me back change for 20. And I saw her do that. I knew she was doing it wrong. I'm sober 3, 4, 5 years. And I took that change and put it in my pocket and walked out to my car and sat down in my car. And I felt about that big. I mean, I thought it was worth more than, I thought my honesty was worth more than $5 or $10. I thought it was worth thousands. And I said to myself, Joe, you sold out for $10. What a deal. So I went back in there and I told the lady, I said, ma'am, you gave me too much change. $10. And I gave it back to her. She said, well, thank you very much. She said, I would have had to pay for that. And I said, most people, she said, wouldn't do that. I said, yeah, but I'm a member of an organization that requires me to try to be honest. And she said, well, I never heard of an organization like that. And I said, well, I hadn't either till 3 or 4 years ago, but I'm trying to be honest. So I gave her the $10, and I walked out. The next time I walked out, I felt real good. First time I was about that big. Next time I felt good about doing the right thing. And so now, I've had that happen a time or two since then, I'm able to give them the money back before I go out the door. Thank God.
See, that's an example of practicing honesty, which is alien to our nature.
Mm-hmm.
But as you practice it over and over and over and over, gradually it becomes an habitual part of our nature. And we really do change into different people. It's amazing. It's amazing the changes that we can make through these steps that we're using, 4, 5, 6, and 7. All right. Now, we got rid of resentments. They were replaced with love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill. We got rid of fear to the level that God intended, and that's replaced with faith and courage. But this little storeroom back here in the back of our head that's filled with guilt and remorse, we looked at those things we've done to other people, but we haven't really done anything about the removal yet of the guilt and remorse. And if I want complete peace of mind, serenity, and happiness, if I want God to direct all my thinking, then I'm going to have to do something about emptying out that storeroom so God's thinking can enter there too. And if I don't do that, the guilt and remorse sits back there and begins to eat me up. The fear of what they're going to say when I run into them begins to eat me up. And gradually that old fear begins to block me off from God, and that old guilt and remorse. And eventually I end up drunk all over again. Now, it's long, long been known how we human beings get rid of guilt and remorse associated with harms we've done in the past. And there's a word that they used, the Oxford groupers, they called it restitution. And Bill didn't like the word restitution, and he knew that other alcoholics wouldn't like the word restitution. So he took that word and he changed that into two other different steps. Steps 8 and step 9. And if I follow 8 and 9 the way the big book says to do it, then I can get rid of that guilt and remorse and fear associated with those things that are in my little storeroom, and I can empty it out. And then a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness can begin to come in there. A little better feeling of self-esteem can begin to come in there. I can begin to feel a little better about myself when I have made restitution for the things I've done in the past. So let's take a little look here this morning for a few minutes at steps 8 and 9 and see what positive results we get from those.
I don't know about you, but I know about me that I have been extremely sick from drinking. I mean, I have had horrendous hangovers. Now, those weren't the things that caused me to want to stay sober, though. It was part of it. I have been extremely physically sick from drinking. Threw up 3 pints of blood one time in the shower. Just boom, like that, it all come out. Thought I was going to die. And that didn't cause me to want to quit drinking. It was some of it, but wasn't the main cause. But the main cause, the reason that I wanted to quit drinking was this. The guilt, shame, and remorse that I had, how I had harmed other people, was just eating me alive. I could not stay sober without thinking about those things, and the feeling of the guilt and the shame and remorse that I had just drive me back to drinking. Those are the reasons why I wanted to quit drinking and get my life straightened out. And steps 8 and 9 is the beginning of those, doing the making those restitution to those people that I had harmed. Generally, if you go into a step study meeting and they're talking about step 8, if you listen to them real closely, the first thing you know, everyone's talking about step 9. As if step 8 doesn't exist. But it's a definite step that needs to be done. Step 8. So now we need more action. Without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8. And then a little bit later we'll do 9. We have a list of all the persons we've harmed and to whom we're willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So now we take all those names off of column 1 by which we've harmed and put them on one long list. And then we become willing to the list. So we subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. We did that when we did step 4 and 5, that drastic self-appraisal. Now we're about to go after our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. Step 8, prayer. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. More prayer. Remember, as agreed at the beginning, that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. I did not want to make amends. Really, I didn't know the need for it. I hated the idea of me going to those people and making amends for the harm that I'd done. I couldn't face myself. Didn't want to do that. I knew I needed to, but I didn't want to. It was a hard step to do. Need more prayer. Can't heal a sick mind without a sick mind. With a sick mind, God had to help me to be willing to do those things. Step 8.
You know, the first part of step 8 is very simple. It's very easy. Because we already got the list. We made it and we took step 4. So the list of all people we've harmed is a very easy, simple thing. The last part of step 8 is the hard part. Became willing to make amends to them all. And the book recognizes that self cannot overcome self. That in many cases we've got to have God's help. And it said if we're not willing, we ask until it comes. We turn to God and ask Him for the willingness to make amends to all these people. It doesn't say anything about making amends. It just talks about being willing to make amends. I'll never forget when I got into this area. I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't think I can do steps 8 and 9. He said, why? I said, because some of those people I've harmed, they've harmed me just as bad or even worse. And I'll be damned if I'm going to make any amends to those people. I'm just not willing to do so. He said, well, Charlie, as usual, you're getting the cart before the horse. He said, step 8 doesn't really, you don't have to make any amends in step 8. You do that in 9. And I said, yeah, but that's why I can't do 9, because 8 says I have to be willing to make amends to them all, and I'm not willing to make amends to them all, so I can't do 8 and I can't do 9. He said, well, let me help you out a little bit. He said, we have the list here of all those people you've harmed, right? And I said, sure. He said, now some people on this list, if you would like to make amends to them right now, just as soon as possible, He said, there's your mother and your father. There's your wife. There's your children. There's your brother. And we named a few more names. He said, you really would like to straighten things out with them right now, wouldn't you? I said, sure I would. He said, I want you to go home and take their name off of this list. Put them on another list and label it right now. Can you do that? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I can. He said, well, go home and do it and then come back. So I came back and I said, now here's the list, what I do. He said, some of these people on this big list are people that you are not sure just exactly when you want to make amends to them. But you know you're going to do it sooner or later, don't you? And I said, oh yeah, there's several names there. He said, I want you to go home and take those names off of that list and put them on another sheet and call them later. Can you do that? I said, well, I guess I can. He said, go home, do it, and come back. And I did. And I said, now here's the list, what I do. He said, there's some of these on here, this big list that you're not sure about whether you're going to make amends to them or not. You may or you may not. Is that right? And I said, well, Neil, you know it is. He said, I want you to go home, take those names off there, put them on a third sheet, and I want you to head it up, maybe. Can you do that? I said, well, I guess I can. He said, go home, do it, and come back. And I did. And I said, here's the list again. What do I do now? He said, now all these that are left on this big sheet, you don't intend to ever make amends to them, do you? I said, I don't ever intend to, period. He said, take their names off, put them on a fourth sheet, and head it up, never. Can you do that? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I can. He said, go home, do it, and come back. And I did. And I said, now, here's the fourth sheet. What the hell do I do now? He said, I want you to start making amends to the right nows. And he said, by the time you're through, you'll probably be ready to make amends to the laters. He said, by the time you're through with the later sheet, I think you'll be ready to start on the maybes. And he stepped back and took a $20 bill out of his billfold. He said, I'm going to bet you $20. By the time you get through with the maybes list, you'll be ready to start on the nevers list. And you know, the old fool was exactly right. He didn't let me use my little highly intellectual alcoholic mind to take a couple of words and cut myself off completely from steps 8 and 9. He gave me a way to become willing to make amends to them all. I've used it over and over and over and over with new people. Works every time. If necessary, just make the 4 different lists, start on the easy ones, work your way through, and eventually we get to where we can make amends to them all. We become willing to make amends to them all. Now, after we become willing to make amends, then step 9 tells us what we're supposed to do. Step 9 is a very definite 3-part step. It tells us the kinds of amends to make. It said we made direct amends. It tells us when to make those amends. It says wherever possible. Now, a lot of people read step 9 to say whenever possible. No, it says wherever possible. You tell an alcoholic to do something whenever, hell, just forget it. It's not going to get done. It says wherever possible. Then it tells me when not to make those amends, except when to do so would injure them or others. And Bill very carefully in the next 2 or 3 pages addresses each one of these issues. Direct amends, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Let's look at step 9 for just a few minutes.
So probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not, and probably should not, emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we're trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It's seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we've gone religious. In the prize ring, we would be, they call us leading with the chin. Why not lay ourselves open to be branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He's going to be more interested in demonstration of goodwill rather than our talk of spiritual discoveries. And I certainly find that most people that I've harmed, business acquaintances in that area, if you go to them and say, look, I've harmed you in this certain way, talking about you, lying about you to our customers and so on and so forth, what can I do to make it right? They'll tell you. So I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm trying to get my life straightened out and getting you and me straightened out as part of it. And they'll tell you what to do. They say, oh, Joe, don't worry about that. I'm just happy that you're staying sober. You stay sober and everything will be okay. Most of them are like that. Some of them, you took a little money from them along the way. And by the way, if you took money from people and didn't pay it back, take a little money with you when you're going to make some amends. They don't want your money anyhow. They want their money. See? Give them a little money back. Make amends that way. It sets you free, you see.
Let's look at this idea of made direct amends. We think there's two kinds of direct amends. One kind is eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one. Now, the purpose in me making the amends is not to get you to like me. I hope you will when I'm through with it. But the purpose of making the amends is for me to get rid of my guilt and my remorse and my fear associated with that, whatever it was that I did. And if I write you a letter, I'm not quite sure how you've received it. I'm still going to be apprehensive the next time I run into you. I don't know what you're going to do. If I call you on the telephone, I'm still not quite sure of how that's going to work out. But if I go find you, wherever you are, your home, your office, wherever you might be, and I sit down with you eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one, when I'm through with that amend, you will have done to me all you're going to do to me right there. I'll never have to worry again about what you're going to think or what you're going to say. I'll never have to worry about whether I've done my utmost or not. He addresses that issue in the next paragraph. He said, we don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we're willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. Now then, he starts on a direct amend. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise.
Maybe he's done us more harm than we've done him. And though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we're still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It's harder to go to an enemy than to a friend. But we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feelings and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we've done our utmost to straighten out the past. We're there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. And if our manner is calm, frank, and open, we'll be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we were calling come on and admits his own faults. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we're doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We've made our demonstration, done our part, it's water over the dam. And every time I read that, I think about my cousin named Gary. Gary and I grew up next door to each other. We were a lot alike, almost a lot alike. And we couldn't be around each other. Because all the time we were around each other, we were fighting and fussing and raising cane with each other, so we just couldn't be around each other at all. After I'd been sober for a while, I was in a restaurant one day. Never been in that restaurant before or since. And I looked up and Gary was standing at the door. Come to find out he'd never been in that restaurant before or since. Now, is that odd or is that God? God makes the wherever possible too, by the way. And I'm motioning Gary over. I said, Gary, come on over. And he came over very reluctantly. He wasn't quite sure what I might do. And I asked him to sit down, and he did. I said, Gary, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to AA, and part of the recovery program for me is to make amends to those people I've hurt. And I've hurt you many, many times during our lifetime. And I want to ask you if you'll forgive me for those things. He kind of relaxed like that, and he said, well, Joe, I want you to forgive me for the things I've done to you. So that whole thing went away just like that. Good deal. But the best thing about it is that from time to time, and for a number of years, Gary would come to AA. He didn't stay sober, but he would come to AA. And when he came to the group that I attended and sat down next to me. We were able to share a little bit about this program. I haven't seen him in a long time. But, you know, he used to be a daily drinker, and I think now he's a periodic. He's making progress, you know. But he comes to our group. Like I said, I haven't seen him in quite a while now. But had that experience not happened a long time ago, Gary probably wouldn't come to AA. Someday I hope he'll be able to stay sober. At least I pray that he does.
Eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one. Another kind of direct amend is in equal proportion. You know, some of we alcoholics, when we're drinking, we tended to run up bills that we never did pay. We tended to borrow money we never did give back. We tended to write hot checks we never did pick up. We tended to tear up automobiles we never did fix. Many of us have hurt a lot of people financially when we're out there doing our thing and doing our drinking. Now, the big book's going to suggest that we do something about that also in order to get rid of the fear, guilt, and remorse associated with those things. In the very next paragraph, he says, most alcoholics owe money. Now, that's probably the understatement of the year right there. We do not dodge our creditors. Tell them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go. For we're liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. And I think what he's saying to me is this. If I owe you some money, I need to come see you. I need to say you and I both know I owe you $1,200. And I don't have the money to pay you today. I wish I did, but I don't. But if it's okay with you, I'd like to start paying you back $10 a week, $20 a week, whatever I think I can live with. And you'd rather have 10 or 20 a week than have nothing. And I start paying you 10 or 20 a week, whatever I can live with. And one day I wake up and I say, hey, that sucker's all paid off. I'm not guilty about that anymore. I'm not afraid of him anymore. I go to the next one. I say, now you and I both know I owe you $1,500, $1,600, whatever it is. Can't pay you today. I wish I could. But I'd like to start paying you 20 or 30 a week. I'm probably making a little more money by now. And I start paying you 20 or 30 a week, and someday I wake up and I say, by golly, that sucker's paid off. I go to the next one. I go to the next one. I go to the next one. And someday I wake up. And they're all paid off. And my fear and my guilt and my remorse associated with that thing is all gone. You know, I've lived long enough to know that time is going to pass. You can't stop it. And as time passes, I can use it for something worthwhile, or I can just let it slide and let it slide and let it slide, and 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, still be worried about it, still owe all that money, and may be drunk in the meantime. You know, we can pay every one of those back if we wish to. And we can get rid of all that fear and that guilt and that remorse. Joe and I had an old friend that used to live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His name was Dan. He was really a mentor to both of us when we came to AA. And Dan's dead now. He moved to California and died out in Riverside, California. He would have been sober how many years?
It would be 53 years come January.
He would have had 53 years January. When he was 29 years sober, he said to me one day, he said, "Charlie, I paid the last one of them last week." And I said, "Dan, how do you feel?" He said, "I feel about 8 foot tall." Dan was a little bitty fellow, about 5 foot one, but he felt about 8 foot tall. He said, "This is the first time in my life that I can remember that I don't owe somebody something for what I've stolen from him in the past." And he said, "I feel pretty good about old Dan." Took him 29 years to pay him, but he did it. When he was drinking, he was in the oil business down in Texas. And he hooked them, and he hooked them big, too. And took him 29 years to get them all paid back. But he finally got around to doing it. Tell you how good a con artist Dan was. His wife, Sarah, one time, beautiful, beautiful lady, turned out to be a great Al-Anon lady. His wife, Sarah, took him to the state insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas, to have him committed for alcoholic insanity. The head psychiatrist interviewed Sarah, and then he interviewed Dan. And after a while, Dan left, and Sarah was locked up. She stayed there for a year, too. And she got the electrical shock treatments and everything with it, you know. He was a great con artist. And Joe and I knew him ever since we were sober up to the time he died. And Dan and Sarah never had a whole lot of anything. But they had a good place to live. They had a good automobile. They had all the money necessary to go to AA conventions and do just about anything they wanted to do. Yet he was still able to pay all these people back. He never did say how much money, but it was thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. If Dan could do it, then I think probably I could do it also. You know, when we read way back in the beginning in the foreword of the second edition, it sounded like when Bill called on Dr. Bob, that Dr. Bob sobered up and never had another drink again. And that isn't exactly true. Not too long after Bill called on him, Dr. Bob decided he needed to go to a medical profession meeting over in Atlantic City. And Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, begged Bill not to let him go. Said, "Bill, if he goes over there, he'll get drunk. He does it every time." And Bill said, "Let him go. Let him go. He's going to have to learn to live in society where there's always going to be plenty of alcohol. And if he gets drunk, we'll do something about it when he gets back." And sure enough, he went to the medical convention. He got drunk. He comes back to Akron. He shows up at his nurse's home, drunker than hell. And the nurse calls Ann and said, "Come and get him. He's over here at my house drunk." And said, "By the way, sober him up. He's got surgery scheduled in the morning. He's the only doctor on staff at the present time that can do this particular surgery." Dr. Bob was a proctologist. Now, I'm not sure what a procto is, but I'm glad he wasn't working on mine the next morning. I know that. So Ann and Bill go over and get him and bring him home. They cough him, they walk him, they sobered him up to the best of their ability. The next morning, Bill takes him to the hospital to do the surgery. In the parking lot of the hospital, Dr. Bob said, "Bill, I can't do this surgery." He said, "I'm shaking and I'm trembling and I'm going to hurt somebody." Bill reached in the back seat of the car, got out a bottle of beer, popped the top on it, said, "Drink this and you'll be okay." Dr. Bob drank the beer, settled him down a little. He went upstairs, did the surgery. Everything came out just fine. Now, the only problem is Dr. Bob disappears. Bill's waiting for him in the parking lot. Hours later, Bill assumes that Dr. Bob, the beer has triggered the allergy, and he's off and running again. So he goes back to Dr. Bob's home. And Bill and Ann wait all afternoon. Late, late evening, Dr. Bob shows up, and he's sober. And Bill said, "Where in the hell have you been?" He said, "I've been going up and down both sides of the street, making my amends to those I've harmed in the past. That bottle of beer was the last drink that Dr. Bob ever took. That was the beginning of AA's birthday. You see, the one thing he would never do before then was make the amends. He just could not make himself do that because he assumed that everybody would find out he's alcoholic and he'd lose his profession, what little bit he had left. He didn't know that everybody knew it already. But the day he made his amends was the day he took his last drink. So if it's good enough for my friend Dan, if it's good enough for Dr. Bob, it's probably good enough for me too. Let's go ahead and look at the rest of these amends.
At the selling table.
What are you guys doing?
Well, my sugar's got real low, and Kathy probably got some glucose tablets, and I need to get a couple of them.
Okay. Bottom of page 78, last paragraph.
All right. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if we're known to our authorities. We may be short on our accounts and unable to make good. We've already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we're sure we'll be in prison or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. And certainly I do too. And I have done. But I think in steps 9, 8, and 9, I think where we need our sponsor more than any other time, or as well as any other time. Because sometimes we go out and make those amends after we get the idea how great they are and make us feel. And we go out there and make some amends to people, then we cause more trouble making amends than we would. We need some counsel on how to do this and why we should do it, when to do it and when not to do it. That's what I'm trying to say. I know I had committed a criminal offense. Thank you.
There we are.
See?
That's what you need.
Thank you. I needed that. So I took a like amount of money, and the people that I took the money from were no longer.